Good afternoon, everybody. Nice to see you. I think we're going to get started here because we've actually got a pretty full afternoon. And Brenda and I are going to do the first part as a joint presentation, and then we're going to have a bit of a break, and then we'll do the second half. We're going to have the, as you know, a conversation about an area where there's very little interest, you know, physician compensation and the incentive fees. No, sort of joking aside, we're really glad you're here. We're really glad we're going to be part of the conversation. And I guess what I want to say at the beginning is we're going to run through some material with you, but the objective here is really to have a dialogue and a discussion around some parts of this as we go through. So I'm going to start off, and then I'm going to hand it over to Brenda, and we'll just get going. So the first trick is always figuring out how the remote works. All right, so this is the obligatory slide that we have to have in just around our disclosures. For folks who don't know me, I'm Mark Armitage. I work at the Ministry of Health in our Health Sector Workforce Division. It deals with all things related to the workforce, including physician negotiations and compensation. And I was asked by my ADM to present on our behalf. We do have folks here from the ministry from the specific branches. So I have my colleague Marie T here. And also my colleague Rod Frechette. So if there's technical questions that come up, you know where I'm steering them, so heads up. Brenda, do you want to say anything before I go? Nope, okay, good. And I have no conflicts of interest, and I don't believe in any managing of bias, at least in this particular area. So I just wanted to quickly give you an overview of what our objectives are for today. So in short, you know that we're on this collective journey around primary care transformation. And the way we look at compensation is it's an enabler and support to the strategic direction. In and of itself is not a strategic piece of work, but it's really should be positioned as a way in which we help incent and support those objectives that we set through GPSC around patient medical home and how we're going to move from where we are to our future state. So the lens I ask you to put on this as we go through is, you know, think about it in the current setting, but also think about this journey that we're on and what our objectives are. The second thing we're going to talk about is the whole issue of just some more details about the various forms of physician payment models that exist in the province presently. So we're going to walk you through those and just give you sort of a high overview of them. And then there'll be an opportunity to ask some questions about them later on. And after the break, we're going to spend some time talking about the GPSC incentive fees. You folks who are physicians will be very familiar with those. To sort of cut a long story short, GPSC has been working through the incentive working group at looking at those fees and trying to figure out you know, to honor what we've heard through visioning about changes that folks want to see and how those are administered and how they're aligned with our direction and the work that we're doing around patient medical home, how do we start to think about repositioning those fees? And so we want to have a dialogue with you about some ideas that the incentive working group and the broader GPSC have been thinking about. And I think the main point I would make here is that these are very much at the idea stage, and this is an opportunity to have a good conversation about them. So I'm going to hand it over to Brenda. She's going to kind of walk us through the first part, and then I'll talk a little bit about the various compensation models that presently exist. Thanks.
Thanks, Mark. I think you all know who I am. So I am an employee of Doctors of BC, and I support the General Practice Services Committee. I do maintain a clinical presence. I work in my clinical office one day a week, so I do understand how all these issues affect us on the ground in our practice. Hi, Cassandra. She sits elbow to elbow with me in my office. So I thought we would just give you a little overview of what's the current state of the union with respect to physician payment models, both in BC, a little word about what does it look like in the rest of Canada, and what about some other jurisdictions in the world. So in British Columbia, for family physicians, the majority are still paid under fee for service, about 73%, which also does include GPSC incentives. And you could argue that the way the incentives are designed, it does introduce some other funding elements, but that is included in the fee for service basket. About 22% are mixed fee for service and alternate payment models, and about 5% are under alternate payment models only. So trends in BC are similar to those across Canada. As of now, most family physicians are still paid fee-for-service in other jurisdictions as well. We know about some of the models in Ontario, et cetera, but the majority across the country is still fee-for-service. If you look internationally, there's a bit of a mix. Like, for instance, in Australia, you have some blended payment, but it's mainly, so some of these definitions as well. Blended means people are paid a combination. So when we say it's blended in Australia, it's still mainly fee-for-service because 10% of the income is derived by capitation and target payments for immunization. In Denmark, there's blended payment, but 63% is still fee-for-service and 28% from capitation. In England, GPs practices receive three categories of payment: a global sum, which is based on capitation, some pay-for-performance, and then some enhanced service-type payments. And in France, they're paid by a national health insurance, but it's fee-for-service. But there's an upfront treatment lump sum. But doctors can charge whatever they want, and the patient or the private insurance makes up the difference. Japan is mostly fee-for-service, but it's an employment-based insurance for the bulk of the population. New Zealand, 28% fee-for-service and 22% by capitation. And we heard a lot about the U.S. yesterday with Dr. Grundy, in that they're making a specific move to change away from fee-for-service within Medicaid and within other insurers, but as of today, they are still mostly fee-for-service. So if we look a little bit more closely at the United States, in January 2015, there was an announcement by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, so that's the publicly funded centers, that by the end of 2016, they were looking for 30% of fee-for-service to become value-based, and they were looking at these accountable care organizations and bundling. And by the end of 2016, they wanted 55% of fee-for-service to switch to quality-based payments. And then they also have a healthcare transformation task force, which is a coalition of private insurers and provider organizations looking to move 75% of their contracts into alternate payment models by 2020. And in England, in the United Kingdom, GP practices, as we said, receive 3/4 of their funding from a global sum, which is calculated according to a formula, which takes into account patient numbers or capitation, along with some adjustment for age, deprivation, burden of disease, et cetera. They have the quality and outcomes framework, which provides incentive payments for reaching a number of disease-based targets, and that makes up to 20% of the practice income. And I think that's where, I don't know if Ralph is here, but he expressed, you know, some of the discomfort that family physicians have in England about the way things have evolved. And then there's enhanced service payments, such as for meeting immunization targets or locally identified health needs. So we have a real mix, but we can see that the tendency, as generally models of care evolve, that there's a tendency for the way physicians are paid to evolve, to try to support and respond to the needs. Must have pressed the wrong order. So really, there's no one jurisdiction that seems to have come up with the magic bullet and said, this is perfect. So there's no single best pay model. Every model has its pros and cons. We know that the Canadian College of Family Physicians prepared a best advice guide, and they came basically to that same conclusion. And so generally, when you're looking at how should physicians be paid, you don't want an unlimited number of options, but you do want an ability to respond to the kind of care that you're expected to provide, and you do want an ability to adapt to the specific circumstances in which you practice. So, as mentioned, we've had feedback from physicians. We had visioning a couple years ago. There's been lots of things happening over the last couple years. We've got a GP for me, we've got impact projects, we've got the proposals coming through for patient medical home development, we've got the child and youth mental health substance use collaborative, we've got feedback coming from divisions and ISCs, and we are hearing a lot of, you know what, the way that we're paid right now, we're feeling limited in our ability to really respond to the desire to practice in a different way with incorporating teams. So that's some of the feedback that we've been getting. Now, if you look at what's allowable under the Physician Master Agreement, does the Physician Master Agreement mean that we're only allowed to be paid fee for service, or do we have to wait till there's a new agreement negotiated in a couple years, or is there some latitude there to be paid differently or to trial different payment models? So the PMA actually sets out within it three payment mechanisms. One is fee-for-service, which we're all very familiar with. Another one is alternate payment models, and those fall into three kinds. Basically, they pay for physician time, but they pay for physician time in different ways. One is a service contract that pays per full-time equivalent. One is sessional contract, so that basically pays you for your number of hours. And another one is similar to the service contract, except that you're actually an employee, where you're paid for being hired. So then under the joint collaborative and the JSC, there's an opportunity to develop models designed and funded from the funding that comes to these committees through the PMA. So there's latitude there, and I think you're all aware of some of the things that you can design there, things that have been designed previously, such as, the maternity care networking fees, all the GPSC incentives, the hospital care fees. All those can be designed under the funding that's available within the PMA, but you're limited to that pot of money. So these three kind of payment mechanisms that are laid out in the PMA doesn't describe all the variations and permutations that can happen, doesn't describe all the possible pay arrangements, and it also leaves open the opportunity to negotiate other pay arrangements when it's mutually agreeable. So the key point is that we do have the flexibility to design new incentive fees. They can help to inform the development of future payment models, and we have some examples of where that's being done. So within the PMA, we have the opportunity to design, to experiment, to test, to refine, and ideally we do that as much as possible to inform what happens within the more formal umbrella of negotiations. So what do we do? So Stephen Brown has come to various settings. We've heard feedback from physicians. If we asked around this room who would like to be involved in maybe testing different funding models, we would probably get a lot of interest. So why isn't it happening everywhere? Well, for one thing, there's capacity issues. Changing to a new model or designing and testing a new model takes a lot of work and input. And so there's a limitation as to how much can be done at one time. And I think Mark can talk a little bit more about that. So when we look at, okay, if we have more desire for this than we have capacity right now, how do we deal with that? Well, what we need to do is if we're working in partnership, we need to look at how we prioritize. And the places that might be experimenting or trialing or moving towards new payment models have to be places that are committed to helping to inform and implement the strategy of patient medical home team-based care. They have to be places that we can learn from. We need to make sure we leave that space and opportunity for testing, evaluating, refining, because we want to do things well. So when we design something, we want to know that it's being tested, and as it rolls out, it will be an asset to the system and not add additional confusion. So we want models to prove themselves to be sustainable, to be able to be spreadable. We heard Paul Grundy talk about that, you know, giving the permission to be able to spread this if it works. We need to really focus on early adopters and not worry about, oh my, you know, does everyone need to switch? The answer would be no. People who are interested, who are in the line with the strategic direction, you know, who we have capacity. It's important that we deal first with the people who are early adopters. So those are some of the considerations that we have to think about. Some of the principles, if you were, that anything that we test should be contributing to the overall strategy. If we have more demand than the ability to deal with it at one time, we need to have some kind of process that prioritizes, that's fair and transparent. We have the ideal governance model to be able to help with that process, and that's through the GPSC in terms of designing a process where that can happen. We need to ensure that we allow people to identify themselves as potential early adopters. And the first question we had, and I'm going to just hand this over to Jeff for a couple minutes, was, what else do you think is important that I haven't put in the list there that we need to have under consideration as an important consideration or principle as we look at how might we go about in our province with designing, testing, implementing, spreading new funding models. So, Jeff?
So, as Brenda said, these are the pieces that that will be used as the backbone, as the principles or considerations that will be looked at will be used to shape what future payment models may look like. They've been built out of inputs from a variety of places, from the visioning and other places, and they really have been heard by the GPSC, but there's an opportunity here to really confirm them, to make sure that they're the right considerations, and also to understand if there are any other things that really need to be considered before the GPSC goes forward in building out these payment models. So I'd like you to take about 10 minutes at your tables, working in partners or threes, and just have a conversation about these particular pieces, to talk about whether or not they're the right pieces and what else they should consider. And at the end of that time, you'll notice in the middle of your table there are stickies, big stickies, four different colors of big stickies. The reason that it says use the yellow sticky is because we want you to use the yellow sticky for this one, okay? You notice that it's yellow? So you have 10 minutes, key considerations, and things that you, if something here doesn't ring true, put that down. Try to make it one per yellow sticky, and we're going to tell you where to put those stickies a little later on. Okay. Just that clarification. We're trying to see, to ensure that these are the right considerations and determine whether there's anything else that should be added to them. Okay? Okay, you have about 30 seconds. You should be filling in your yellow stickies. The good news about this is you don't have to do anything with your yellow stickies right away, so you can keep writing while these people are talking. It's a great thing. Okay? You should be listening. Okay, so but wind up your conversation now. Okay. Anytime. And we're going to come back to the presentation.
All right. So it's great to hear all the discussion. And as Jess said, if you want to keep writing as we carry on with the presentation, feel free to do that. But if you could all focus back up here, that would also be helpful because we've got a bit more content to get through. So I'm just going to walk through some of the various compensation models we have, some of the pros and cons associated with it. But I think it's important before we do that, that we understand the strategic context in which we're doing it. Because as I mentioned at the beginning, compensation models are an enabler and a support to what we're trying to achieve around physician compensation, around our strategic direction. And so we need to have a series of touch points that we stay connected to or are aware of as we go along. And so, I would say there's sort of three or four of them right now that are sort of critical. Obviously, there is the outcomes and the from visioning that we heard. So that is obviously a significant consideration for GPSC and the ministry as well. We've talked a little bit about the journey we're on around patient medical home and primary care networks and the importance that we are setting up compensation models that incent team-based care, that incent longitudinal care, that incent full family practice. So all of those sort of main principles or tenets of that initiative need to be present when we're thinking about a compensation model. There's a couple other ones that I wanted to just mention, and one of them was the Auditor General did a report in February of 2014 on physician compensation. And for those of you who haven't looked at it, you can find it on the Auditor General's of BC's website. And it's essentially a report that looked at whether the Ministry of Health, health authorities, and the Medical Services Commission could actually demonstrate whether or not we were getting value for money for physician compensation. And you know, to cut to the sort of the end of that report is that what they basically said is they couldn't see any direct sort of evidence of that. Now, that's not to say that money's not being used in a good way to do a whole bunch of good things in the way of care for patients, but as far as the evidence to be able to demonstrate a straight line through there, it wasn't as present. And so what they basically said is that we should be mindful of that going forward in how we design our compensation models, because ostensibly it's taxpayer dollars that are coming in. There's an accountability within government to be able to understand how that's being used and where the value of it is. And there's a series of recommendations in that report. They break down into sort of six big categories. And so it becomes a bit of a touch point or a lens that we at the ministry apply, because we have a sort of an accountability or at least an awareness to make sure that we're lined up on that as we go forward. The other, and to sort of build off of that, is that whole issue around value-based compensation. And sometimes that's feels a bit nebulous to be able to sort of define that. So we've been doing some work sort of thinking that through a little bit. And this definition may morph a little bit or change, but ostensibly what we're thinking is that for value-based compensation, it needs to incent improvements to quality, health outcomes, cost effectiveness, and the experience of both patients and providers, rather than volumes and activity levels. So as you can see, and we'll see as we go into the slides, that the fee-for-service system is set up really as an activity and volume-based, as opposed to what the Auditor General would talk to us around a value-based compensation system is. So, as we go through this process and talk about these models and the pros and cons of each one of them, these are some of the lenses that that I would argue that the ministry brings to its thinking around it, and that GPSC needs to bring as well to its thinking around the incentive fees. Now, just as Brenda mentioned, we've got a series of different payment options presently within the province. There's obviously fee for service. I think of alternate payments as an umbrella, actually, for a whole series of potential options. So you've got alternate payment contracts, you've got population-based funding models, you've got blended models. So sometimes it gets used as a term around just a simple contract, but I think it's more appropriate to think of it actually as an umbrella that can cover a number of different forms of payment models. So this is the one you folks are most familiar with. Obviously, the fee-for-service. A couple of the sort of benefits and concerns that have sort of come with this is, it does reward physicians for high-quality care, and they're motivated to provide services because of seeing patients to address their issues. And it does recognize the relationship that occurs there. If you've got a longitudinal relationship, you're coming back, they get to know the needs, and you're able to bill for those. Some of the concerns around it is, and these are sort of extreme, so I don't want to leave the impression that this is the mainstream, but there is the potential for it to drive a high volume and low acuity visits. And I just think we need to say that. And it doesn't necessarily incent illness prevention. It's really a reactive system based on what somebody comes and presents with. And it does also incent that single visit, as opposed to, in some cases, holistic care. Now, I know that that lots of physicians don't practice that way. They don't practice sort of one issue, one visit. But that is a bit of a tension point, potentially. Now, with population-based funding, we actually have two versions of it presently in the province that I wanted to just talk about. Back in the early 2000s or late 1990s, the federal government provided some money to the ministry to initiate a population-based funding model in the province. We started out, I think, with somewhere in the neighborhood of 18 sites, both that were physician-owned and operated and run by health authorities. Over the 2000s, that number actually contracted. It was primarily on the health authority side that it contracted and not on the physician side. And I think presently around the province we have 8 sites that are presently up and running. And so that has continued to carry on. From my perspective, it was a good foray into looking at a different compensation model, but it kind of went into a period of abeyance. Like it was being maintained and operating, but the ministry didn't look to expand it during that period of time. There's lots of good work that went on with those sites and with folks at the ministry to understand how to what they were learning through there. There hasn't been a formal evaluation per se done. Certainly, I think it's been a very good collaborative relationship between those practices and the ministry to learn about the value of that model. And for those of you who don't know, our friend Mitch here from Langley has been in that model for the whole time. So if you want to learn more about it, he's an excellent resource for it. So that's one option we have. We are in the process of onboarding a new site in Mission right now. What we're learning as we go through that process is that things have shifted a little bit for us between then and now. Some of the things that have shifted is some of our legislative framework around privacy. And so we've had to go back and go through quite a rigorous process to make sure that the model is able to be utilized and expanded in our present context. And so that's taken quite a while to get through. I think on the positive side, we're getting pretty close to getting it done. And so we're hoping to learn from both that process and then to figure out, and we'll talk about it later, but just about how it may become a future option going forward. The other area that we've got a population-based funding model up and running is in Fort St. John. It's different than the original sites. The major difference is how the payment is calculated. In the traditional or the original population-based funding, it's based on a panel, and it's based on the complexity of care or burden of care that's determined by using John Hopkins ACG codes to transform individual patients' health issues into a sort of a block payment. On the Fort St. John model, it continues to have a part of the payment generated based on the number of patients that are on the panel. There is a pay for care, so similar to the population-based funding model, based on acuity or burden of care. The third component, which is a new sort of addition, is around quality. And I would say that's an area that, you know, we're collectively trying to find our way with the folks in Fort St. John around and with the health authority. And our friend Bill over here is our resident expert, so he can correct me if I get this wrong. But my understanding is that at this point, quality is looking at looking at the lifetime prevention indicators as a bit of an assessment around the quality of care and getting a sense of how that they are being changed by how the clinic is operating. But that particular model, we're about a year into it, the existing contract ends at June 30th. We'll be extending it, and you know we've got some good learnings from that year. But just like the population-based funding model, we haven't done a formal evaluation on either one of these, and so we flagged that we need to do that because there's a series of both clinical issues and administrative issues associated with operationalizing these models that we need to understand in more detail, because it really gets to that whole question and point that Dr. Grundy made yesterday about ensuring that whatever you bring on, you have to have the ability to scale and sustain. As far as the benefits go, I mean, they're kind of covered off there, but it does allow for longitudinal care of patients. It does provide enhanced level of care of patients delivered in a flexible way. And what that means is that the clinic or the physician is receiving a block payment and then has some latitude on how to use that funding to meet the patient needs. And so it does support team-based care, and so the physicians have the option of deciding who's going to be on their team to meet the health needs of who's on their panel. The challenges around it, or not challenges, more the concerns, is that there is a level of administration complexity to it, because you still have to do encounter reporting. You have to make sure that who's on the panel at the clinic level is aligned with who the ministry understands is on the panel, so that we're getting the payment correct. Those clinics continue to meet on a regular basis in a sort of a community of practice to talk about how things are going. And so, I think on balance, it's a very good model, but there are continued to be some accountabilities in there, or some administrative processes in there that make it complex. And so I think what we would like to do is over time is try to automate as many of those, or to simplify those as much as possible. So I mentioned earlier that alternate payments can be used as an umbrella, or it can actually just be used as a simple sort of contract model. So in that context of a contract, we do have places around the province where we are doing alternate payment contracts with physicians in the community. They tend to be in rural or remote areas so that there's an income guarantee for physicians who are practicing where there's a low population. The benefits of it is that it's pretty administratively simple. They're usually typically run out of the health authorities. It's a negotiation. You sign the contract, and then the physician has got some comfort or guarantee around what their income is going to be for providing the service. I think on the concern side, I'm not sure if this is a real issue or a perception issue, but we have heard anecdotally that folks have concerns about their autonomy in it. And whether that's administrative or clinical, you know, I'm not really sure, but you know, that's something that we on occasion hear from physicians, that they're just are a little concerned about the potential of that. And the other part is that sometimes there's a concern because there is no productivity incentive in it. It's a payment, the physician receives it, whether that physician works 35 hours or 60 hours, there's no variance in the compensation in there. And so, you know, that has both, you know, there's on the positive side, you have a guaranteed income. On the negative side, you know, if you're having to work additional time, it's not sort of formally recognized within that model. The next one I want to talk about is just sort of blended funding models. And again, this can be considered a bit of a catch-all. Just to give some examples of what potential blended funding models could be. For those folks who are on a population-based funding model, they panel some of their patients onto a roster, but they have the flexibility to have some that are not on a roster. And so they are receiving a block payment, and they also have the ability to bill the fee for service. Also, within that model, you've got a set of payment codes that are within the basket of services within the model, and then you're going to have things which are outside of the of that basket. And those ones that are outside of that basket, they're allowed to be billed fee for service. So even within population-based funding, you can still have a blended model, technically. We have this little debate sometimes thinking that the fee-for-service is, and when you have the GPSC incentive fees, one could argue that it's a bit of a blended model as well. Even though they're both paid on an encounter basis or volume basis, they are essentially blending what is two different systems of payment. A third one that you may have heard about yesterday was just a journey we're on around nurse in practice. You know, again, that is a could be construed as a blended funding model because you have physicians who are predominantly on a fee-for-service model, looking at contracting with the ministry for a nurse to come into their practice, and so you're blending two different funding sources there. And again, the last one I'd give as an example is probably something like an income guarantee, where we've arranged for someone to go into an area, an income guarantee has been provided as an incentive for them to work there. They continue to bill fee for service, partly for, in some cases, for the health authorities to recoup the income guarantee that they've made. But if they earn above that amount, then they obviously are taking the benefit of that home as well. So. My point really here is that there's various forms of blended funding models, so it's hard to sort of talk about them as one thing. There are some general benefits and concerns around them. One is that it supports team-based care within fee-for-service, and it allows for healthcare professionals to maximize their scope of practice in some of those settings. The concerns are sometimes it's unknown if it will substantially increase access or attachment. And there's potentially administrative challenges in these as well, because you're not just using one mechanism to have income come into the practice. You've got two or three things that you're managing at the same time. So those are sort of the major buckets that we have at this point. What I'd say about funding models generally is that we obviously work in a negotiated environment that's outlined in the PMA. And Brenda covered that off. And we know that the PMA runs until 2019. It's an opportunity when it reopens to have conversations about a whole host of things, including compensation models. In the sort of the period running up to that, we want to collectively learn and have a dialogue about what are our options and where we might want to go in there. So we have to think about it in that context. And, you know, from the ministry's perspective, we recognize that there's a dominant payment method in fee-for-service. We recognize it's got some strengths, and many physicians have fixed or sunk costs related into that model. But we also know that we hear that it's challenging, really, to use that particular model to move forward on team-based care and the the patient medical home. So we're looking at how do we look at some of these other options that I've covered to bring them online in a more robust way. The tricky for us is that as a system, we need to, I would argue, and I think we would at the ministry would say, we need to land on sort of three or four options. What we can't have is like 15 or 20 options, because they just become way too administratively complex to manage and to operationalize. So, you know, what we're doing is looking at the suite that we have, wanting to have dialogue about them, and then looking to pull out of those the critical elements that we believe are necessary to align with our strategic direction, which I covered off around patient medical home, around value for money, and around honoring the voices envisioning. So those are the things that I think are really important to think about as we go forward, because those will be some of the lenses that we're applying in figuring out how we're going to what we're going to land on and how we're going to move forward on them. So the big question is always, okay, so now what? So what are you going to do? So I think what I'd like to just sort of highlight is that the conversation about compensation models happens within a broad context and within a sort of a broader environment. And so these things are drivers that we need to keep an eye on as we go. So obviously the first one is, for us at the ministry, is this political context. You're all very aware of the present situation we're in. What I would say is that I think from a public policy perspective, the ministry feels like it's in a very strong place with respect to the strategic direction related to primary care and patient medical home. When you look at other jurisdictions across Canada, you see that most, if not all, are looking at how to improve in primary care for all the reasons that Dr. Grundy spoke about. We have no indication that any of that sort of direction is going to change. What is potentially a driver, though, is when the process that we're in around government forming comes to an end, the political platform of the party that's at power will influence that. They're going to have priorities. We're going to need to engage with a new minister and talk that through. And so that's going to be an influencer in this process as we go along. The second is the policy piece. And, I think GPSD's done an excellent job of articulating patient medical home and what the attributes are. You heard Doug Hughes mention yesterday that the ministry's been doing some work around the policy elements associated with that from the ministry's perspective around system stewardship. It's building on all the good work that's been done, so it's not like there's a radical change in there, but it too is an influencer on how we move forward. On the issue of budget and funding, until we have a government that's tabled a budget, we're operating based on what we heard previously, which was the government's statements around a $90 million investment over 3 years into primary care. You know, we have some work that we need to do back at the ministry through this process that we're in to confirm those numbers. The other part is we know under the PMA what the budget increases will be to GPSC over the balance of the PMA. So we know what that funding envelope is. There's discussion obviously within the committee about how those funds are allocated. So those are some of the pieces that are moving there. The other part that I mentioned earlier around some of our models is we haven't done these formal evaluations. And so, part of ensuring that we can scale up and sustain a model is we believe we need to do some more robust evaluation around some of these to make sure that we understand what the implications are of expanding them. And I've already kind of covered off the PMA renegotiations piece. What I would say is that our folks from the ministry and from HEABC have been meeting with Paul and Todd to talk about that in advance of the formal negotiations. And there's a dialogue that's going on around that in preparation. So I think that's a really good indicator of our shared interest to move through this in a collective way. So that will help inform what those discussions are. And the last thing I'd say is that we're very aware, both at the ministry and at GPSC, we need to start to nail down a clearer implementation plan. And so my belief is that between sort of now and the fall, that's as some of these things get more solidified around our political context, the budget, that we're going to need to come back with a more clear implementation plan to be able to explain how and where we're going to start on this journey. So that sort of in a nutshell is kind of where we're at right now. And I'm not sure how we're doing for time, Jeff, whether we want to do questions or...
We won't have time for questions okay. now, but we will ensure that we develop a process to answer questions.
Okay. Can we take 5 minutes for questions? Give me 5 minutes, because people might ask. And the reason I do that is because I gave a presentation a number of years back and I didn't have questions and I heard about it for months afterwards.
So but you can blame me.
No, you can blame me. Okay, so maybe two or three questions and then I'm happy to be available on a break. Anybody have any questions?
Right at the back.
So I'm Dean Brown, a GP from North Vancouver, and we're in the midst of trying to implement primary care home initiatives with practices on the North Shore. And I was at a meeting this morning from 8 to 10, and my task going out the door from both the health authority partners and from the docs in the room was, Dean, go solve the remuneration thing for the docs. And I said, is Thursday soon enough? And they said, well, if it takes that long. So all to say that if we want this primary care home thing to roll out well, we need to get onto solutions soon. And what I'd like to know is there openness to entertaining some one-offs, like with a few small groups of physicians on the North Shore? Because I have ideas on how this would work. And if I put it in a proposal between now and Thursday, would it be entertained?
Okay, so that's a great question. And you're not the first to ask it. And actually, a number of practices or clinics have come forward. What we've offered to do is to meet with those practices and clinics through GPSC and sort of hear what the thoughts are, to talk about kind of where we are, and to keep a list. As I said, what we don't want to do, we need to have a bit more of a robust implementation plan, and we don't want to just one-off it going forward. So if you want to present your ideas, then please let us know. It will come in through GPSC, through the co-chairs, and we will absolutely arrange to have a conversation with you about it, but we're not going to be implementing any one-offs between now and when we have our implementation plan developed in the early fall.
Yeah, I was just wondering about if there's any talk about this so-called shadow billing. You know, like through our GPSC, we had a few incentives where the physicians worked with a practice nurse. When the funding disappeared, the program left as well. Now, I've heard from some physicians who have a practice nurse or a psych nurse or somebody, a physician helper, and then they have a quick visit with the patient as well, and now they bill, and now they're able to fund that helper, that other team member. If we all do that, it's going to have a huge increase in cost to the MSP. So, I mean, I don't think that's sustainable. Have we looked at that at all?
So, what I'd say is the whole issue of shadow billing is a bit of a tricky one, because I know it's an administrative burden. I know we've had conversations about sort of the privacy issues associated with that. On the flip side, unless we actually collect that data, and understand what what's happening at a practice level in an anonymized way. So I want to really emphasize that anonymized way. We're not interested in PHNs or any of that, but understanding what those practice patterns are. It's very difficult to understand whether something is actually giving you the benefit that you want. So that's the sort of the environment that we're in. In nurse and practice, we do need to have that shadow encounter reporting. It's really in the context of quality improvement, and it's a conversation that we're having with those practices, and they will be part of the process of defining what information gets looked at and how it gets looked at. So I think that it's too early to get into the bigger issue about cost associated with all of that, but we've got it. Our argument at the ministry is that you need to have that to understand what the patterns are and whether this is achieving our strategic goals. All right, I got maybe time for one more, Lee, and then I'm going to get off the stage because I'm out of time.
It's not necessarily relevant to the physician compensation one, but I certainly know from our GP for Me work and from visioning work that there is a real desire to continue to work in teams. And I know a lot of clinics stepped up to do that with NPs at one time when overhead was actually covered. And then there seems to have been a decision somewhere along the way that overhead was no longer something that would be considered in terms of funding those health human resources. So can you explain where the reticence to cover overhead as a piece of embedding these people in practice has been from the ministry side?
So I'll give as best a go of this as I can. So in the NP4BC initiative, which basically brought a number of NPs into the province to work for health authorities, what the ministry funded in that process was the salary and benefit costs. And the expectation was on the health authorities to cover the overhead piece of it. And it's been a bit of a contentious issue between the ministry and the health authorities. But that was the original sort of vision around it. Around nurse in practice.
Mike, it was just like the previous contracts when they were actually embedded in physicians' offices, overhead was covered. And then there was a decision rather than embedding these people in the primary care system as it exists in our practices to embed them in health authority only and to expect the health authority to cover the overhead. So I just didn't quite understand why the original NP contracts that first came out were embedded, we have them in our region and all over the province, and overhead was covered as a piece of it. And then suddenly the decision was not, and that was only gonna be embedding it in health authority spaces and the overhead was expected to be covered there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think what it reflects is sort of this journey we've been on around how to bring NPs into the primary care space, and in the nurse in practice process that we're involved in, and the contract that's developed, it's a block payment. It does incorporate a component for overhead in there to try to honor that issue that you're raising, that it needs to be thought about in the payment that's actually provided. So I recognize that there may have been a bit of a windy or bumpy road along some of that, but we've been mindful in sort of going forward about how we try to address it. All right, so I'm going to pause there just in the interest of time. If you have other questions, I'm very happy to take them when we have a break. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you. So we have just a little bit of time. There, can I get the flicker here? And I'd like you to at your tables, but again in groups of two or three, just because we don't have an awful lot of time, we have three questions we'd like you to consider. The answers we'd like you to answer individually, and again we'd like you to use the stickies. So the first question is, when you look at the various models that you've heard, either from other jurisdictions or the models that Mark has described, what is it about them that excites you? What about a given model? What excites you about that model, the way that you might practice? What is it in that model that you really think is a positive thing that you'd like to see? Use the green for what excites you. Use it for the second question, what concerns or worries you? Use the pink. And for the last question, are there aspects of other models that you know about, something that might not have been covered here? Are there aspects of other models that you really think that are worth considering? And why do you think they're worth considering? And that's using the orange. So you have three questions. Talk about it with your partner and then use those pieces of paper. We'll give you a few minutes and we'll come back. You'll have more opportunity as we go on to be able to answer those questions, to write these answers in as well. Okay? Okay, I'm going to ask you to wind up your conversations. Please make sure that you get your ideas down on the stickies. This is an opportunity for input that we really would appreciate you taking. Get those ideas down on the stickies. At the end of the session, I'll let you know what we need you to do with those stickies. Before we go to break, Dr. Ross is going to take a little bit of time to review the short-term changes to the incentive fees. I know this is stuff you're all a little bit interested in. Perfect. Everybody goes quiet. I love that. Okay. So, Shelley, I'll give it to you.
Okay. So thank you very much, Jeff. We've certainly been sending out little hints that there's changes happening with the incentive fees. So we thought we'd take a moment just to go over what we have done so far. And then we'll be looking for your participation in the next session after the break of ideas of where you want us to go further. So we're currently carrying out a process of reviewing and redesigning the GPSC incentives. And the idea behind this is to better support GPs in their transition to the patient medical home. So I'm going to provide you with an update on the redesign. And do I have slides? But I may have slides, but I don't have a clicker. Nope. Big green. It's too big, that's why I can't see it. So the GPSC envisions three phases of changes to the GPSC incentives. And today we're happy to share the information with you about the short-term changes to the incentives. And details about these changes are provided to you in your handout that's at your table. So if you want to refer to that. And we'll talk a little more about these changes momentarily. And also for today, we look forward to consulting with you on four new ideas that we aim to develop for the medium term. Mark Armitage and Dr. George Watson, our incentive working group co-chairs, will provide you with an introduction to those new ideas, followed by what we expect will be thought-provoking conversations, because I'm sure everybody has ideas, as well as an opportunity to hear from you on ideas that you have for the incentives to better support the patient medical home. So finally, it will be important for us to collectively think about potential changes to the GPSC incentives in the context of our current physician master agreement, because there's going to be a new PMA negotiated for 2019, which is really not that far away, and this may present new opportunities for longer-term changes. So we're talking about short-term, medium term, and long term. So let's look at the short term changes, the current ones, which I'm pleased to share with you. So based on the GPSC visioning process, the overwhelming feedback that we received about the incentives was to simplify the administration of the fees, align similar fees so that the rules are easier to understand, and to support team-based care. Since the visioning process, we've continued to review and assess the needs of GPs and divisions with respect to incentives through such activities as the PMH funding submissions, the appreciative inquiry process, the GP for me evaluations and reports, and numerous conversations at the practice community and interdivisional levels. And based on these processes, the GPSC has approved several changes to current initiatives, which are outlined in your handout. These changes aim to do three things. The first is support team-based care, as team-based care is a foundational element of the patient medical home model. And some of the fee changes will facilitate the delegation of some services to a college-certified allied care provider. The second one is to simplify and align the similar fees. And the third is to continue our commitment to longitudinal care. So some of the incentives from a GP for Me program will continue as they support the GPSC's longstanding commitment to longitudinal care. So we recognize that many of you may have questions regarding these fee changes, but we'd like to be well prepared to answer these questions and also provide the opportunity for your physician colleagues who may not be here today to ask their questions. And we want to be sure that we have enough time to hear your feedback on the ideas being considered for future changes to the incentives. Therefore, we request that you please write your questions down, and there's boards available to do that. And what will happen is these questions will be taken into account for the development of a webinar, and that webinar won't be that far in the future, so that we'll be able to answer your questions about the short-term ones, what we talk about with the medium-term and the long-term. And communications from GPSC will be sending out information about the webinars. So I won't ask for questions. I won't be like Mark. I will allow myself just to say thank you. Enjoy your break. And then when we come back from the break, we will talk about the medium and the long term. So thank you.
So before you go, and not you, not you. Before you leave, you have some homework then. So your homework. This room is going to be completely reconfigured on the break. So you need to take all your stuff when you go. You need to take the stickies that you've been writing on, all of the stickies that you've been writing on, and you need to look for Ranjit, and she will tell you where to put them in the hallway. Any questions that you have around the short-term incentive fees, there's a big board out there, which Ranjit will also point you to, and you should write them down now. Now, this is critical, because the desire here is to be able to ensure that all of your questions are answered in the upcoming webinar. We know that there will be lots of areas for clarification and questions, and that in that webinar, we want to ensure that at least the questions in this room, as well as other questions from doctors in the province, are properly addressed. Okay? So that's the final thing is you need to go to the registration desk and look for the big pink card that says Susan on it and sign it. And you need to come back here in half an hour, and in half an hour from here, we'll be doing a deep dive conversation on what the incentive fees and incentive program will look like in the future. Now you can go. Thank you.